Welcome to another episode of The Cubic Report. We're so very glad that you joined us today. My guest today is Mitchell Moss, who's a design production manager for Beyond Today magazine and Compass Check magazine. That's just the tip of the iceberg of his life, because that's probably not what we're going to be talking about very much today. We have another topic in mind. But he's also a menswear writer, and that's the topic that we'll be getting into more. He's a personal image consultant, photographer, and commentator. He is a graduate of ABC, Ambassador Bible College, in 2010, and he's been working with the United Church of God. He's been managing editor of the United News and also with Compass Check. And, the one thing that I really appreciate about him is his eye for design and his eye for style, and I really noticed the work that he did with Compass Check. And lately, if you have the Beyond Today magazine, there have been some significant design changes, and those are the responsibility of Mitch Moss. So with all that, first of all, I want to say welcome to the podcast, Mitch.
Thanks so much, Vic. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Mitch lives in Cincinnati, and we're doing this. He's actually at the radio studio at the home office. What we'll be talking about today is a subject that I have not really known too much about as far as a lot of details are concerned, because it's not my field. I know that when you see Mitch and the way he dresses, you know that there's something very special about the way that he takes to that particular field. But anyway, we'll be talking about clothing, and you say, well, what are we going to say about clothing? We're going to primarily focus on men's clothing. He does have a website, menswearmusings.com. So we did a number of topics to discuss. I'll just like to read a little bit from, and I'd like to have him explain a little bit about the associations that he's with and the people that he works with. But in a brochure called Manifesting Character, put out by the Atelier Munro, Amsterdam, here's a description of Mitch Moss. And I wanted to read just a paragraph of it. Mitchell Moss is one of those menswear writers who speaks to what you could wear rather than what you should wear, always advocating self-exploration over the expected. But it's his philosophy of flexible dressing that initially drew us to his work. Growing up in the Midwest, it was the internet that allowed his horizons to broaden across the world and eventually shaped his distinct style, a beautiful fusion of American aesthetics with Neapolitan refinement and tailoring traditions. And I know that Mitch had talked to me about going to Italy, to Florence and other places. But before we get into clothing, I'd like him to explain some of the associations that he has and just what I talked about that I didn't really fully even explain fully.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I really appreciated that that quote there. It's been a while since I've read that. So you, like you mentioned, that was put out by Atelier Munro, which is an Amsterdam-based made-to-measure clothing company. And they have, that is their customer-facing business, Atelier Munro, which is, they have their own stores in Europe and in Canada. But here in the United States, if you wanted to become a customer of Atelier Munro, they have desks set up in multiple menswear locations around the country. So here in Cincinnati, Trevor Furbe Bespoke is the name of the local place that you would go, and Atelier Munro has a desk. They have swatch books. You can get measured there by their local tailor, who's been trained by Atelier Munro, and then you can pick, you know, what you want to have. And that is a company that I've done recently a campaign with. The second, it's been a two-part campaign. The second part is going to launch here in April of 2024, highlighting the spring summer clothes that we put together. But that came about because I was attending a menswear trade show in Florence, Italy, called Pitti Uomo. And it happens twice a year. I was there in January of 2023, and the creative director, Joachim Bahn, who followed me on Instagram, reached out to me and noticed that I was there in Florence for the trade show and asked if we could have coffee. And he said that he followed what I did and liked what I was all about. And what they wrote basically was kind of what he said to me, I mean, in so many words. Mm-hmm. And we discussed working together. And so what that entailed was a photo shoot. They flew here, their whole team from Amsterdam. We shot a lookbook here in Cincinnati, and then we drove to Nashville. Because when we first met, I was living in Nashville at the time. And then I told them I was moving to Cincinnati, so we did a photo shoot in both cities. And then we flew to Florence for the June 2023 edition of Petit Uomo and did a photo shoot there. And as part of that, I curated some looks, I guess you would call it, from their upcoming seasonal collections. And that's what you see there. And then we did an interview, and what's printed in the book that you just read from is some style advice that I wrote for customers of theirs, and it was printed in that final book. So that's my connection with Atelier Monroe. Other things that I've done over the years as a menswear writer, of course, I've got my own blog and Instagram presence that I write under Menswear Musings. And I've also, I kind of got my start with a website called Styleform. Back in the pre-social media days, and you probably remember these days well, forums were kind of the big way to interact and engage with other people about topics on the internet. So Styleform is one of those. I think it started in 2002, and it's just a place for men to talk about clothes. And I started being interested in that when I was in college, maybe in 2008 or something like that. Joined and started really admiring the clothes that I was seeing, specifically tailored clothing, and learned more and more about it. Eventually, I became a member. I was a member there. I was contributing there. I was posting there, learning there. Primarily, everything I know I learned through posts and what I learned from members there. And then they started a blog, and I would write for their blog. And then eventually in 2020, January, I went to Petit Uomo for the first time as a member of a team from Styleform. I was a photographer there. So that was my first time there. And it was because of Styleform that all of that was possible. After the pandemic, in June 2022, I went back to Petit Uomo but for myself, on my own dime, as my own way to try and broaden what I do in this world and meet people and expand my horizons and create opportunities. So yeah, those are kind of the big calling cards for me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you explained that, because I know that you were talking about that, and I thought, boy, one day here's Mitch and I walking down the hall, and then the next day he's on his way to Florence, and then he talked about the opportunities and the people that he met there. So that was very interesting. So thank you very, very much. But let's start talking about the subject of clothing. I had asked you to outline a few things. And one thing I might just say from the outset, clothing can be a controversial subject because, and you'll explain some of the things that are involved with clothing and how clothing has had its highs and lows, what the Bible has to say about it, what the Bible doesn't say about clothing. Also, the difference between clothing for men and the clothing for women. Normally, when we get into the subject of clothing, it's women's clothing, you know, and that becomes the hot thing, you know, in the discussion. Everything from propriety and modesty and everything. And men just are always there, you know, they're just kind of
right. Yeah.
In their suits. But Mitch has some very, very interesting things to say about the subject of clothing. And really, we're going to stay with men's clothing. So maybe we could talk about clothing overall as a major theme in the Bible. Let's start with that, okay?
Sure, yeah. It from the very beginning, I mean, page one of the Bible, practically, Genesis 3, you know, Adam and Eve sin. They choose to take the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and immediately become aware that they're naked. So they create little coverings for themselves. And then after that, God finds them and gives them animal skins when they leave the garden, which right there automatically sets up clothing is a symbol of man's separation from God, that that they had to wear animal skins. I mean, that right there automatically tells you that the first animal sacrifice took place, you know, when God had to kill an animal to be able to give them skins to wear.
Mm-hmm.
So automatically, clothing in the Bible, just without even saying it, is a, you know, but reading the subtext, it is a symbol of man's separation from God. And throughout the Old Testament, there's all kinds of meaning interwoven, so to speak, into the different types of clothes that you'll come across. One of the more interesting ones that I recently was fascinated to learn a little bit about was in when it's describing what the priests wore when they were setting up the tabernacle. It mentions that they have to specifically wear linen trousers, and it says so that they do not sweat, or no, and I think it says no clothes that they will, so that they will not sweat. And you think, well, first of all, that's weird. You're going to sweat probably either way, but you know, wool is going to make you hotter than linen. So okay, I appreciate that. But that in itself is a reference back to the curse when they left. And it says, God says, by the sweat of your brow. So it reinforces, it's part of, you know, a lot of different symbols that's baked into the tabernacle and the tabernacle service. And, it, you know, there's cherubim on the wall and the curtain that separates the Holy of Holies from the main temple chamber, representing, you know, the cherubim at the entrance to the garden. So this is this place that represents Eden in so many ways. And even just the clothing, that reference to sweating is a reference to that curse. So the priests are there serving as in this place where God and man can come together like they were in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the high priest had garments, and it talks about his ephod. It talks about his turban that he wore. He had this breastplate with all these gemstones that represented all the different 12 tribes. And of course, you can't forget the clothing related laws themselves, the tzitzit, the tassels that they were required to wear, which were meant to remind them of the law. And there's the famous Shetnez prohibition against wearing wool and linen specifically,
right,
mixed together. And, you know, those are symbolic things. I mean, those are laws meant to, in the case of the tzitzit, to remind them to always think of God's law and to remind them of their relationship with God. And the wool linen is part of a grouping of laws that remind them that they are to be separate from the world. They are not to mix with the nations of the people of the nation that they're going in to possess.
Yeah, I know that when I travel overseas and meet with some of the Christian Sabbath-keeping groups overseas, they bring this up, the law of linen and wools. You know, they're very, very, very particular about that. And they said that the two fabrics mixing together kind of weaken each other. I mean, they had different philosophies or theories about what that was for. But that's interesting what you had to say just now.
Yeah. And, you know, you can maybe there is a benefit or a con to it. A lot of times in the modern world, I do see wool and linen mixed textiles. And I also see specifically a lot of times mills will add silk to it to add a little bit of a sheen. The linen gives it breathability, but the wool adds stability. But in terms of, like what you said, the physical properties of them canceling each other out or something like that, I'm not sure. But I mean, and I was just talking about this with one of my coworkers, Clint Porter, the other day, and he mentioned there's an example in Jeremiah of Jeremiah's something, he does something with clothing, and it's very sort of visceral, and I didn't look it up before this podcast, but there's clothing all over the place. Zechariah, there's a prophecy or a vision where the high priest of the day comes before God and he has filthy clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, don't worry, I've given you clean clothes so that you can, you know, serve me again. So like the clothes at the beginning are a symbol of God's separation from man as sort of like the default overarching umbrella, you know, sort of meaning. But then they can also, then they become this symbol of man standing before God. And, you know, that's, like I said, through the priests and what they wear, they're wearing these things, linen that helps evoke, even though we're still in the fallen world, you can get closer to God, not closer to him through what you wear, but the symbolic meaning of it can help evoke that. What the priest wore, the clean clothes represent righteousness and purity.
Mm-hmm.
The dirty clothes, you know, do not.
Yeah.
And all of this extends into the New Testament, of course, as well. So we can talk about the New Testament here if you want to.
I know the New Testament does speak of clothing. I mean, everything from the wedding garments were sort of the appropriate dress for a wedding. In fact, even the whole subject of being in the kingdom of God is symbolized by the clothing that you wear. You know, having proper clothing is symbolic of character, symbolic of righteousness, symbolic of what it takes to be in the kingdom of God. And then also, to be one of the more interesting passages is about discrimination of clothing. I've taught the book of James, you know, for several years at ABC, and talking about not showing favoritism to people for the clothing that they wear, which is interesting because it's not just everybody to be all the same, but to show respect for those who can't afford clothing and to discriminate against their character because of their lack of, you know, whatever that gay clothing was. It's an old archaic thing, you know, but their apparel as being something that made them be number one because it symbolized them being wealthy and influence. and you know, people can benefit from them. So
yeah, anyway, there's so much loaded into that. Like what you said, clothing is universally in every culture of the world will be used to as a way to symbolize or show in groups and out groups.
Mm-hmm.
In the New Testament era, of course, it was the Roman Empire, and we think of the Roman toga famously as like, you know, what you picture of Romans as. But, you know, something I didn't know until I started recently reading into this, the toga was actually only to be worn by citizens. Only citizens were allowed to wear togas. So that automatically, if you owned a toga and wore it, you're a citizen. That symbolizes your in group versus mm-hmm. out group. And the togas themselves had different decoration. So people who are in the Senate, members of the Senate, theirs were decorated a certain way. I'm sure certainly the royal people of royal families or nobility or, you know, certain ones in certain groups. But going back, you mentioned the wedding garment because you could kind of break things down into the symbolic mentions of clothing and the literal mentions of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So like one of the first things that comes to mind is Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, don't worry about what you're going to wear because God, you know, takes care of even the, you know, the lilies of the field. And King Solomon was not dressed in all his splendor. This is sort of like one of the, I say, a literal mention in the sense that in your day-to-day life, he tells us not to be so materially focused and not to hoard treasure on earth, but to hoard treasure in heaven. In other words, your righteousness, your relationship with God and what you do there. And then the symbolic meaning, the wedding garment was another one that I was recently reading about. And I learned something new about that because in that parable, this is a symbolic one. Jesus uses the wedding garment to symbolize somebody's acceptance of this invitation to this wedding, the wedding. So in the parable, this king it's a king that's important. He's having this wedding. He invites these guests and they reject it. And they even kill some of his servants or whatever. So he says, he gets mad and he says, okay, just round him up off the street. So they round up all these people and they come in and then the king enters the hall.
Mm-hmm.
And finds, and this is the parable, he finds a man who's not wearing the wedding garment, and he chastises him and throws him out where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And the man is presumably mortified, obviously. But what I didn't realize is that if you think about clothing historically, it's very rare, it's precious, it's expensive, and only the very wealthy would have been able to have more than just one, maybe two sets of clothing in their daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Think about like Samson in Samson's story. He makes a wager of 30 outfits. It's like 30 linen garments and then 30 outfits or something.
Yeah.
When he tells one of his riddles, he gets betrayed. So then he has to come up with these 30 garments, right? So he goes out and slaughters all these Philistines to do it. That's the story. But that's the reality of clothing in that time period. And so in this parable, the wedding garment itself is not something that you would have been expected to come up with yourself. It was actually, historically at that time, and even since then in Middle Eastern cultures and Asian cultures, kings would have wedding garments on hand, sort of like today you go to certain private clubs or you go to certain restaurants where they have a dress code with a jacket required.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have loaners in case you show up and you're not aware or you don't have one. They can give you one. That's what the wedding garment was.
Mm-hmm.
So for a man to show up to the wedding, to be invited by the king, he would have been given a wedding garment. So if he's not wearing it, that indicates that he has refused the free gift of the king who's given it to him.
Huh.
And chosen to reject the free gift of the garment. So there's an additional meaning to that parable, you know, once you learn about it. And in Book of Revelation, you mentioned that it talks about the saints having clothes that are white linen that have been washed, and it's a paradox, washed in the blood of the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And it later even specifies the righteous acts of the saints. It's these white linen clothes, which kind of goes back to the priest idea. That's kind of the same symbolism that the priesthood had. It's the same symbolism of this time period where God and man were not separated. So those are sort of some of the symbolic mentions of clothing in the New Testament and Jesus' teachings. And then, like you mentioned in James,
mm-hmm.
He specifically says, you know, don't judge people poorly because they have poor clothes or righteously because they have nice clothes, because mm-hmm. Those are just external adornments. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then you also have the writings of Paul and Peter, of course, who are talking in their writings to women, although I would say that they would be universally applicable to both men and women, but about don't let your adornment be external with showy things and showy braids of your hair and stuff for women.
First Peter.
But let it be internal. And mm-hmm. and Paul echoes that same thing when he writes about how to dress.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, I think it's interesting because every basic major religion of the world, and the Abrahamic religions especially, have written down sort of guidelines and sometimes letters or just admonitions by different, and even like I said here in the scriptures, about what should you wear in worship, what should you wear when you come together as a group, and even what should you wear in general as a person, how should you carry yourself, how should you adorn yourself. You know, you look into the Jewish history and the Jewish guidelines, you can go back, and they say basically what the Christian traditions say going back all the way back to, I mean, even the New Testament, that generally speaking, in terms of what a worshiper should wear, that clothing should be plain. And these are, you know, basically based on the guidelines that Paul and Peter kind of lay out for women, but that it should be plain, not showy. It should be modest. I mean, we think of modesty in terms of, for some reason, it automatically goes to women's bodies, but really modesty is what it says about not externally showing off, really, is what modesty is about. It's about, you know, we talk about the word modest means, somebody of modest means. In other words, they're not super wealthy. So clothing should be modest. And, you know, the Jewish traditions show that, the Christian traditions show that. You know, if you look into Islam, they have rules about this as well, in addition to talking about bodily modesty, how much of a man has to be covered when they're in worship, and that's in Islamic traditions as well. So
now I know that working with the Ukrainians, you know, this is my connection, is that when I came to the first services there, it was very obvious that the women were very, very modestly dressed. It wasn't to the point of Islamic dressing, but, you know, they were all covered up, their arms covered up. And they made sure that they did not show off. And they were very, very particular about the verse about let not your adorning be in, you know, all those extra things.
Yeah.
And I tried to explain to them that talks about that your adorning should not be in those things only. It should be by your character and everything. But of course, they didn't really fully, you know, we didn't fully agree on that point, because they just felt like you shouldn't wear earrings, you shouldn't wear all these other accessories, because they made a display of vanity. But it's just interesting how different cultures see things and how they apply them.
Yeah. You know, one of the things when I think about modesty, especially the menswear thing, is a lot of it is subjective. If you want to bring it into the modern world, the biggest thing I would say today is, what labels are you wearing? What brands are you wearing? Like, that's going to communicate wealth probably more than anything else. But then again, some people might not be aware of those things. Recently, I was talking to somebody who didn't even know who Ralph Lauren was. So, like, that's, if you, like, if there's one person in the history of like, you know, menswear in the last 200 years, that's the one guy people are going to know, if nobody else. So even that, you know, that can be in the eye of the beholder. Sometimes I've seen people on, like, mainstream Christian internet discussions call out famous, you know, youth pastors that kind of get a big following, because they'll be wearing sneakers that are, if you're in the know, you know that those sneakers are trading on whatever on the internet for $1,000. And there's hype sneakers, and that's been a trend for the last 7 or 8 years. But you know, if somebody showed up in sneakers like that, I wouldn't know that. So there is a subjectivity to it as well. And obviously it's cultural, because every culture, like you said, you go to Ukraine, it's one way. You go to Africa, it's going to be a different way. What they consider modest in terms of external showiness, not in terms of, like, showing body parts, but what they consider modest in terms of showing off your wealth or extravagant displays of wealth will be different as well, just because it's going to be subjective in that regard. So I guess, you know, if for me, the takeaway is don't wear an obviously gold Rolex, you know, probably to church. If you can afford and own one, don't wear labels that are, although again, like I said, if somebody doesn't know who Ralph Lauren is, that, you know, all bets are off. But you know, there's certain things that you can wear that are, and like gemstones and over jewelry and all that stuff. Like, I think that's kind of what it's getting at, is because you don't want, in other words, everyone is a brother or sister in Christ. And James is saying, don't judge people for those things. So he doesn't say don't wear those things. Yet at the same time, Paul literally does say, don't let it Mm-hmm. You know, don't let these things be. Just sort of an analogous thing too is the Passover service, where he talks about the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians. He's saying some people are coming hungry, some people are having these extravagant feasts, and so he just made this judgment call, like, we're just going to come and have this group meal, and it's going to be very bare bones, because we don't want this disparities of wealth mm-hmm. to come between what the most important thing is, which is this communal worship of God together in this sacred meeting. Mm-hmm. So I think those are kind of like the universal spirit of the law principles that, like, each of us should, like, internalize and think about when we get dressed before we come to church.
Well, one thing I'd like to just kind of maybe circle back on, which I was going to ask and didn't, is that when Jesus Christ was crucified, one of the things the Roman soldiers did was they threw lots to see who would get his clothes.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
why would you want to do that? And, you know, the explanation was is that he was wearing something very valuable. You know, who would get his cloak? You know, like you mentioned, the cloaks were something that was worn by citizens, by senators and others. And obviously, it also, John the Baptist, you know, wore camel's hair. He wasn't some caveman. You know, that was a nicely styled garment that he wore. So it shows that there was quality even by the leaders of the church there. John the Baptist, Jesus Christ mm-hmm. specifically mentioned, is wearing quality clothing.
Well, I mean, quality is one of those eternal sort of like discussions, because something, what's the phrase, pay once or buy once, cry once. In our mass-produced world today, it's easy to buy unlimited poorly made clothes. Mm-hmm. And as natural resources become overextended, you know, through this, like, over, like, cashmere, for example, is like a really easy example of how cashmere goats, the rise and increase of desire for cashmere has led to an increase in the herds of in the cashmere region, which has led to overgrazing, which has led to almost dust bowl type conditions in that part of the world, mm-hmm. making the hides or the fibers from the cashmere goats themselves worse quality. So it's like a declining spiral down. Sorry, I just got on a side tangent there, but I just mean a quality garment that will last, that's well made, that's made from made the right way one time. It's an eternal principle there, and you can obviously assume that the best that you can afford and that you're able to get to is the best that you should get. I mean, today it's because of our industrial production, it's a little bit what constitutes quality does not always equal the highest price, because the highest price, a lot of times, it's overinflated pricing. The markers of quality are not always.
And who endorses it, and, you know, where it's
overhead costs and the marginal costs and all that stuff.
One thing I'd really like to get into here, and I don't want to cut this short, the subject of wear for public occasions. You know, we talked about what we should wear for church, you know, and what we have mm-hmm. In our culture is to be wearing for men a suit and a tie. Although I see that kind of going shifting a little bit, because you talked about the fact, I really appreciated your paper that you had here, that the Beau Brummel, you know, look, the
totally,
you know, of 1910 to about 1970, but then even in the business world, people have kind of slacked off from the total business model. And even when I began working in the church, you know, at the headquarters in Pasadena, we wore suits and ties, I mean, all the time. Mm-hmm. And even when we went visiting people, I was a ministerial trainee, they said, don't wear sports coats, wear suits, you know.
Totally.
Here we're visiting people on farms and just wearing suits all the time and dry cleaning them. And, it was one thing, but of course that's changed to where it's far more casual now. But I'd like to have some discussion about that, because people become very judgmental about those who wear casual clothing. A lot of it is just the culture and the tradition of that church at that particular time and showing of respect. But I'd like to hear your comments, Mitch.
Yeah. Obviously, the first caveat that I'll make is obviously that culturally it's different everywhere you go. So, you know, just within the context of quote unquote the Western world, talking Europe and the tradition of Europe and the British Isles and the United States and, you know, the Western world as we think of it. Like you said, things have come down in formality. Just as a brief history of what I would call coat and tie, because it could be a suit, or which is matching jacket and trousers. Not, you know, not everybody understands that distinction. They'll just see I almost never wear a suit, but I get told nice suit all the time just because people recognize the form. And I always appreciate that comment, but obviously an odd jacket with different colored trousers and a different fabric and a tie. So coat and tie is kind of the phrase that I use, but, mm-hmm. It has an interesting history. I mean, I don't want to wax too poetic on it. I mean, but if you think about, in some ways it's a very utilitarian and a very democratic garment or a form of garment because of, you know, where it came from. You know, think about in the 18th century and before, what did the nobility and the royalty of Europe wear?
Right.
And you can look at paintings in any, you know, church or whatever, or museum. And it was colorful. It was complicated. It was frilly. Men and women. Mm-hmm. Men wore high heels. They had complicated, you know, boots, breeches, all these different things, and cravats that were lacy and waistcoats and. And it was colorful, and it was had gems, and it had, you know, all this extra external gaudery, I guess you could call it. And in the late 1700s, a man named Beau Brummel became famous. One source that I really thought was funny, they described him as what we would call today an influencer. Mm-hmm. And he was a man about town. He had influence. He was friends with the Prince of Wales. And he wore the same thing every day. And it, compared to that nobility, it was extremely restrained. And it was... in a form that we would mostly recognize today, if you look up pictures of him, it still looks a little extra compared to what we would wear today. But a tailored coat, I think it had tails like you would imagine a morning jacket, mm-hmm. if you know what a morning jacket looks like, with cream-colored trousers, just one, you know, at the time, pant, you know, leg covering for complicated multi-part affairs. This is one, you know, one tube of fabric, basically, that each leg would go into. And then regular pants and a white shirt and I think a cravat and... That basically evolved and it caught on at this time in history when it was the late 1700s. Enlightenment principles were leading to democratic revolutions everywhere. It was leading to, you know, executing, you know, in France when they overthrew the government and they were executing mm-hmm. these nobility. So it was just like poised to become this like perfect every like change, sea change from complicated, frilly, something that elevated the nobility above everyone else in a mm-hmm. very noticeable way. Mm-hmm. Because again, remember, throughout history, people would have one, maybe two sets of clothes, maybe some for working and some for public and or, you know, not yeah. working, being at home and or going into public, and plus whatever they need for whatever weather. So, you know, the nobility, the kings, the queens, the royalty, they were elevated so far above everybody else and it was noticeable. So you got... But Beau Brummel introduced was extremely restrained and it evolved and caught on basically around the entire Western world. So that by the time you get to like Abraham Lincoln, about 80 years, 90 years later, mm-hmm. what he wore, and you can see his, you know, what he when he died, when he was killed, what he was wearing. And what he was wearing is more or less the same thing that President Biden would wear today. And actually, maybe even made by the same company, Brooks Brothers. Mm-hmm. So, that form caught on, and they call that period when, you know, they when the nobility forsook those bright, colorful types of clothes and went into this more, much more restrained palette of blacks and browns and dark navies and olives and, you know, all this, the tailored clothing that we think of today. There's a name for it. They call it the Great Male Renunciation. Mm-hmm. So which is this interesting thing. So in some ways, the suit, the coat and tie as a general thing, is this great equalizer among everyone, because by the time you get into the 20th century, it became the uniform and of course the industrialization. And I mentioned Brooks Brothers. Brooks Brothers became like the de facto American company of textiles because they would make things ready to wear. That was an mm-hmm. innovation in the industrial age, rather than everything being sewn on an individual basis for each person, tailor-made for them. They created patterns and sizing and, you know, mm-hmm. all that kind of can be standardized so that into the 20th century, you see, and you can look at archival footage of just, you know, a day in the life on the streets of London or whatever, everybody's wearing a coat and tie. Mm-hmm. And as the middle class grew, that made it possible and ready to wear costs, clothing costs came coming down. And that's just what everybody wore. So it was, in a lot of ways, it was this great equalizer.
Well Mitch, you know,
uniform.
When I went to college in Bricketwood, England, we mm-hmm. wore we wore a coat and tie every day to class. That was standard. We didn't think of it as being ostentatious or anything, but that's what we wore. And it wasn't just for the day you gave a speech or anything. It was just all the time.
Yeah. So it's as a uniform, it allows a certain amount of self-expression, within the context of business, maybe not at a school or maybe at a school. If it's a school uniform, pretty much they try to make those mm-hmm. identical as much as possible. So there's levels of self-expression in terms of what fabrics, what colors you wear. But, that was all governed by good taste anyway. So, what was considered good taste would be sober, restrained colors, maybe a pinstripes, maybe you'd have graph checks in your shirt, maybe you'd have but all of those are governed basically by what did the British royalty do? How did they wear these? Where do these fabrics come from? Were they worn in town? Were they worn in the countryside? A lot of that, those sort of rules came from those sort of historical usages. But as life became more casual, especially after the World War II, you had the 60s where people just got, everything kind of changed in the 60s culturally all over the place. Coat and tie has not, there's really, it's kind of like I kind of describe it as the great white shark of clothes. If you want to think of it in terms of like the evolutionary world, which is an analogy people might not love, but, they say the great white shark is so perfect as a creature that it's never evolved. It's been mm-hmm. the same for 20,000 years or whatever. But just from that analogy, I just am saying the suit, it hasn't changed, and you can, I know in the 70s they had lounge suits and they have these different things, but like the things the way that it emphasizes the male physique, mm-hmm. In Beau Brummel's day, part of the appeal of it was that it mimicked the perfect proportions mm-hmm. of, they were obsessed in the Enlightenment period with the Greco-Roman sculpture and mm-hmm. the male proportions and all that stuff. Well, that's what a jacket is designed to do, is to emphasize wider shoulders with a narrower waist, a more athletic physique. And so it's kind of like that, but as people have, it's kind of at its peak form is what I'm saying. And there's different variations of it with morning dress and tails or no tails, but just the what they call the suit now is basically what was called the lounge suit 100 years ago. I mean, that's basically it. And so as life has gotten more casual, as industrial production and globalization has driven prices for clothing way down, mm-hmm. meaning that today people can get tons more clothing while spending significantly smaller proportions of their annual budget mm-hmm. On clothes. And you can look up these statistics in the 60s, what they spent, in a normal budget per year versus as a percentage of their income versus today. It's significantly lower today, yet we have so many more clothes. And as things have gotten more casual and life in public is less expected to be formal, and also I would tie it to just people's attitudes about live and let live, sort of those attitudes that come about in the 60s where we all just want to do our own thing and not be judged for it. Mm-hmm. You've gotten things more casual to now where this formerly very equalizing form of dress, coat and tie, that crossed the middle class was sort of the accepted norm. Mm-hmm. That everyone could, you knew the expectations, which is the power of a uniform. Now suddenly it became the symbol of conformity to a certain societal way of life and your buy-in. And now if you wear a jacket or coat and tie, you're bound to be asked, oh, do you have an interview today? Like, why are you so dressed up? And so I can't remember if you wanted me to like wax poetic what your question was, because that's just sort of the reality of the life that we live in.
I'd like you to wax on that. I know that here just recently I went to a presentation by the director, the AI director at the University of Indiana, a very, very important person, there.
Yeah.
And, he came to speak to our Rotary Club, and, he was wearing a sweater. But he looks so good. The technical people, they look like they're like he's busy instead of just there for show. And it looked so good. I like to wear a sweater. I don't like mm-hmm. to be stripped down to a tie. Now, at one time, that's what it was expected. And to show respect, I would not want to just look like I'm flouting what the norms are, or going to church as a speaker or as a person who participates to kind of go against the grain, against the tradition. That would be another issue of showing disrespect. But frankly, I do like the morphing and changing to more casual.
Well, what I was going to say is, I mean, the sweater thing, there's pros and cons, obviously. The pro being comfort. Part of it, too, is like tailored clothing, ready to wear tailored clothing. If you are outside of the norms of what the ready to wear patterns will fit, then it can be miserable because if you're too big or you have a bigger build, but you're not super tall. The way that most jackets and things scale up in size, they get longer. So it might be too long for you if it's wide enough in the shoulders. So that's like obviously a pro there is that it's going to be more comfortable. And the other thing is it's much fussier to wear a coat and tie because it's dry clean only. Like you mentioned earlier, you're going on these farms in the 70s or whatever. And it's, you're having to get your stuff dry cleaned all the time. Whereas you wear a pair of jeans and they can be well-fitting jeans that are unadorned and plain and not calling attention to themselves. They're not dirty. It's not like you wore them to work. It's not like you're clean, working on your car and got oil stains on them. They're just clean, dark rinsed denim. And then if you get spill something on it, you can machine wash it.
Right.
And it's fine versus tailored clothing. It's this existential crisis if you spill on these pair of pants. So
spill something on dry cleanable stuff, I'm afraid to talk to my wife about it because she says,
I know.
I can't. I got to take that to the dry cleaners. I can't be fixed.
Totally. Yeah. One of the big aspects of my journey to learn about and develop my style with tailored clothing is that I love the form of a tailored jacket. And in that Atelier Monroe thing, they mentioned Neapolitan tailoring. That's my favorite sort of form. There's like British Savile Row tailoring. There's like French tailoring. And there's Italian tailoring. And even in Italy, there's Northern Italian and there's Southern Italian. And Southern Italian is where it's at for me. And one of the reasons is that in the modern world, if I'm wearing a full coat and tie outfit with tailored pants, maybe it's a suit, it does look very dressed up. But if you can wear a tailored jacket dressed down with a pair of jeans, let's say, or a pair of whether they be dark, indigo jeans or white jeans. I love white jeans. I wear them all the time. Or, something else like chinos or something like that. That's much more attractive. And I feel that Neapolitan tailoring fits that model much better because it's less structured. It's much more relaxed in its silhouette. That's a big part of it. And especially now that I have small kids, the pants are much harder to keep clean than the jacket. So like I can wear tailored jackets and keep them relatively clean, but it's pants that you're just game over, They're very small and their hands are usually dirty and they're always touching your legs.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about the things that we had talked about tying together. Some of the things that we talked about here as far as advice that you can give to the audience that this podcast is for, which is really, first of all, for everybody. I mean, it's not just to the people that we know in our church, but it's to all people as far as just attitudes towards clothing. I think that we covered a lot of that in the very beginning about how clothing, I hate to use the word evolved, but how it started with animal skins and then it, moved to, being something very, very expensive and all the other things that we had mentioned. But give us some advice here about where we go from here as you see this change in styles and change in attitudes and change in what people are doing.
Yeah. I guess the thing that I always try to emphasize when I write about clothes, and my particular point of view is very much tailored clothing centric. So obviously it's not going to be for everybody because, like I said, if you want to look good in tailored clothing, there is a certain form to it that, if it's not tailored right, can look very sloppy. If you have your sleeves are too long, is one I see a lot. Or if your build doesn't suit the ready-to-wear patterns that you see out there, well, that just means you got to take it to a person who had to train for 10 years minimum to become a master tailor, Or I guess there's alterations shops. So I'm in the tailored world, and that's what I like. And but for me, even within that world, or actually, I think this is universally applicable. I always try to emphasize, first of all, fit is the most important thing. So like you said, that guy, the AI lecturer, he was wearing a sweater, but I'm sure it fit in a certain way. And maybe he had that flattered his body type. The three kind of pillars that I say that animate what I write about and where I'm coming from are that deep down, all of us, I think, want to just look cool. you know, which is like how others externally outside of ourselves perceive us. But we also want to feel cool so that mm-hmm. we ourselves feel good about what we look, how we look, that we are, that we're presenting ourselves in a way that we can feel confident in. And we want to express our style in a certain way.
Also, one thing I'd like to interrupt too here and say, and it's a matter too, which I had come up in discussions with others, is our thoughts about the people that we're around, consideration that we show for others, is not to put them down or not to show disrespect, but also to conform, not to the standpoint of just conforming to conform, but to show respect of not being overboard, but not being underdressed to a place, but to really indicate respect for the people who have invited you or who have created mm-hmm. an event, and you show disrespect by not wearing the proper thing.
Yeah, I mean, that parable of Jesus with the wedding garment has that extra layer that I learned recently that I just communicated about, the fact that the wedding garment was a free loaner, you know, from the king. Mm-hmm. But that still is evocative of the attitude that you bring to it, which is, yeah, like you said, consideration for those around you and for whatever it is. So in public life, you know, I think we shouldn't just take it for granted that that in this world today, you know, let me do what I want and don't judge me. I think we should take consideration of other people and what we dress as much as is within our power. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some people are going to take offense at certain things and you can't please everybody. But the goal is to let your character speak for itself.
Right.
Rather than your, your external appearance. And that's the ultimate goal. Now, you know, at some point, every sci-fi show eventually shows us all wearing jumpsuits. I don't think we're ever going to go there because you still also want that level of self-expression. But, you know, especially for events, you know, funerals and weddings. And I was recently went to this to a Cincinnati chamber. Let's see, it was an orchestra performance. And I wore a sport coat, and my two kids, Sterling and Luca, both age 5 and 3, also wore a blazer. See, Sterling wore a blazer. They dressed up. I can't remember if they wore blazers, because you know these people have put all this time and energy to rehearse this music, and they're putting on this performance in public. And it was actually even in a church. Mm-hmm. Like I think it's important to show them respect for the time that they put into that, and for offering it to us in their performance. That doesn't mean I think everyone there who wasn't wearing a sport coat was poorly dressed.
Right.
It has nothing to do with judging others, but about us judging ourselves. And how we can show the optimal amount of restraint, but also of consideration for others as people that are in society. Mm-hmm. And but ultimately, it also shouldn't get in the way of actual righteous acts, because as much as the symbolism of clothing is there in the Bible, the actual, where the rubber meets the road is what Jesus says, which is about letting your treasure be in heaven, and don't be overly concerned with these material things mm-hmm. at the expense of your spiritual condition.
Right.
So, but then we're at practical, practical considerations though, like you were asking, I was talking about fit and about expressing yourself. And, I will say you can get into trouble by adopting the clothes that you see of other people and not understanding their cultural heritage. You know, you've heard of stolen valor. Mm-hmm. There's certain things, like if you wear certain military type things, it's like if you wear a jacket with patches on it, but you were never in the military, like there's that concept. Uh-huh. And there's a fine line on some of that stuff. Some things like aviator sunglasses and black motorcycle jackets, like anyone can wear and it's fine. But then there's other things. So, you know, try to be educated about what you're wearing. Most things that people are wearing though nowadays, to me, it kind of goes back to those directives from the religious texts. It's let it be plain. Let your character speak most of all.
Right.
And I think quality, like we talked about, the best quality that you can afford. And with things like thrifts and like eBay, you can get really good stuff, really, mm-hmm. really, really high quality stuff for much, much less. Sometimes without, it just seems like you're getting away with something. It's so cheap. Mm-hmm. But that also requires you to train your eye, train your hand in terms of what good textiles feel like, and training your eye in terms of what fits you and flatters you. And so, it's not like, it's just like any other area of life. The more you know, it's the curse of knowledge sometimes, because the more that you know, the further away from the ideal that you might mm-hmm. start to develop, you realize you are. But it is rewarding to be able to train your eye, train your senses, and to be able to find and educate yourself and to be able to find those gems that become staples in your wardrobe that you get to wear and you get excited about every time you put them on.
Well, this has been very, very valuable. I know that I'm looking forward to the Feast of Tabernacles this year because I'm going to Mexico and the dress code is rather casual.
Well, you're still going to be hot and sweaty no matter what you do. So,
but I still rather be hot and sweaty. Appreciate that. Yeah. But I know that I have traveled, for example, to the Philippines, and the dress code there is barongs, you know, the sarongs right. for the ladies, barongs for the men. I loved mm-hmm. it. I loved it. Don't have to tuck it in. It just kind of hangs on the outside.
Yep.
And the more it hangs, the better the people seem to like it. And I love that. But then I go on an hour and a half flight to Hong Kong, and there you wear a suit. You know, there is part of the
British. It's very hot and muggy there.
Yeah. Tradition. Then my wife and I, we've traveled to Africa where, you know, we work in some of the poorest countries in the world. And you come to church services and everybody's wearing a suit and tie and shirt. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just amazing how that tradition has gone through there. And to show respect, you know, we have to kind of blend with the people as to the things that they wear. So,
yeah, I think that cultural aspect, and I'm most educated about the tailored clothing traditions, but that aspect of the cultural aspect is so I appreciate it because if you think about obviously if they were some sort of like New Testament directive of this is what you shall wear, it wouldn't survive. I mean, past 500 years later because the culture has changed. The world has changed. The toga would, you know, the Roman Empire wouldn't have even existed. Let's say they would have, you know, somebody would have, so there would have been some text of some local deacon saying, this is what everyone has to wear. And that's what everyone's trying to get back to. Like, I mean, that's the aspect of culture and cultural expression and everything. I think it is a testament to how Christianity is a religion for all people at all time that, the principles and the spirit of what God expects of us are able to conform or, you know, that cultures can still express these eternal principles mm-hmm. of respect and reverence and brotherhood, but in a way that would look totally different and alien 500 years later, 500 years earlier, or even just across the globe. I mean, I just think that's a testament to how God works with us throughout human history.
Well, Mitch, it's been just wonderful talking to you. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I know that there's a lot of things we talked about here, there. They kind of went on this little limb and that one little limb. But I think that it's good to hear just all of these things and try to make up our mind as to what's the best. But it really gets down to respect. It gets down to consideration. It gets down to modesty from the standpoint of humility and properly showing yourself. And all this is part that's displayed by clothing. So are there any other, go ahead.
Well, I was just, the last thing I was going to say is that, and I've at one time in the past, I've even taught at ABC and given a class sort of about clothing. And one of the things that I would always emphasize there is, and at least we have sort of mentioned this, but it's just what James writes, where, you know, somebody comes to church, you see somebody at a wedding, you see something, you know, I myself am getting dressed for this occasion out of respect for others, but this isn't about me then using that standard to judge everybody else and condemn them either mentally or even verbally, because you don't know somebody's personal circumstances in terms of, you know, maybe a guy's working three jobs to be able to provide for his family, but he still wants to show the couple respect by showing up to their wedding. So he's not able to come in this perfectly prepared thing. It's just what he was able to take with him, you know, after work or something like that. Mm-hmm. You don't know those circumstances per se. So it's not about judging others. It's not about having this sort of like self-righteous attitude of I'm better than everybody else. That
right.
literally defeats the point
absolutely
of everything that it says. So that's one of the other aspects about this is it's like people can easily slip into that. It's the clothing's power to signify in groups and out groups. And everyone who's in is always judging people who are out. And that is not what this is about. But but everything else that you said is all the same things that I always think about and try and relate to people.
One book we had in college was Clothes Make the Man.
Totally. And Mark Twain said, clothes definitely make the man. Uh-huh. Naked people have little to no impact on society.
Or too much. Yeah. Anyway, Mitch, it's been great talking to you. I appreciate you taking the time and hope we can maybe talk again sometime.
Yeah, appreciate it. I really, really enjoyed our conversation, Vic. Thanks so much.
Okay. We'll talk to you again.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ciao.
Ciao. Thank you for listening to us today on The Cubic Report. We welcome you to share this podcast and tell your friends about it. We can be found on a variety of platforms, including Apple and Google Podcasts, Pandora, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Audible, and many other platforms. You can easily find us at any browser address box by typing in the words The Cubic Report, and there we are. Remember, Cubic is spelled K-U-B-I-K. So we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at vcubic@gmail.com. That's vkubik@gmail.com. Again, thank you for listening. Come back soon for more.